I'm really sorry about that. So, yeah, so as you know, we're in a rather in-depth series on the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, sometimes called the Torah, though that could be expanded to include the whole Old Testament. And the goal of it is to help broaden and understand our entire view of the Christian faith. That includes its background. And if you think about it, that's the kind of thing people should be doing when they adhere to a belief system, is ask questions like, what are its roots? Who are the key players in this? What are the historical documents or evidence that back up the claims? It's again, just like Paul writes in Romans chapter 9 about the people of Israel. Theirs is the adoption to sonship, theirs the divine glory, the covenants, the receiving of the law, the temple worship, and the promises. Theirs are the patriarchs, and from them is traced the human ancestry of the Messiah, who is God over all, forever praised. Amen. So rather than Christianity beginning with Christ, as the name might actually suggest, it's important to appreciate for all of us that Christianity is, of course, realized or brought to fruition or maturity in Christ. And this is reflected, of course, in Matthew 5. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And so the long story of God's plan to redeem mankind, of course, as I said, did not start when Christ was born, and it didn't end when he was taken up into the clouds, but his birth, life, death, resurrection are all a continuation of a pre-existent faith in the one true God, Yahweh, and his plan. What is, of course, less clear is how all of this applies or does not apply to the believer who chooses to align himself with this same God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Lost my place. Sorry about that. I didn't think I was going to do that. So what we've covered so far, we go back to part one in discussing the genres found in the Pentateuch, which Wendell did. First, we address the law and the approach of using a paradigm to understand the intentions of any given law that might come up. And so this allows us to view the individual laws that were given under the Old Testament and then to use additional revelation found in the New Testament to best apprehend its deeper and fuller meaning, because ultimately they would be anchored in the unchangeable nature and character of God, which is, of course, an important point. And then covered the Old Testament narrative and the most common type of genre in the Old Testament, which is defined as the purposeful telling of stories and historical events, but with really multiple layers. And again, here we have not just simply viewing the individual events, but also viewing them in their immediate context, which in this case would be Israelite history, but also for us especially being able to understand it in the broader framework of what we would call redemption history. And last week, we did a brief overview, a very brief overview, to take in the scope and the sequence from creation to where the Israelites basically come through the back door in the desert of Moab to the land of Canaan and are getting ready to enter it. But for today, before we get into the major themes found in the Pentateuch, I wanted to just briefly revisit the idea of a paradigm or the overarching principles we should use, because I think that can be a complicated topic a little bit, and I was thinking about it quite a bit this week, and the question is, what do we do with the law on a practical level? And of course, Wendell addressed the sum, I just had a few additional thoughts. For me, it's helpful to kind of really organize and put things in structure. So I was thinking, if we go from Old Testament law to interpreting it in the New Testament context, we basically have one of three possibilities. And I had this whole thing set up about explaining the trichotomy law in math. I deleted all of it, so it was a bad idea. But of course, we have the first case where something is not directly stated as far as going from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and we're left wondering a little bit what to do, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But of course, we have the other two cases where you have something that is directly stated as no longer being in effect, so that we are not in question about that. And of course, the opposite end, we have things that are stated as remaining in effect clearly. So something not directly stated, for example, and Wendell spent time on this in sermons, there's no shortage of books written about this, is how do we handle Sunday, or what we might call the Lord's Day, and to what extent this relates to the Sabbath as a day of rest, or what does it mean to keep it holy, and are we still to do that? So there's a considerable amount of discussion within the Christian church on this topic, and so again, setting up how we go about understanding and interpreting the New Testament feeds into what we do with this information. to manufacture a paradigm for things that are clearly not in effect or are still in effect, again, then is to read too much into the text, and that is where we would want to avoid using it and being a little bit too creative, if you will. The sacrificial system is a great example of this. As we know, a good portion of Leviticus is devoted to this. It includes not only what kind of animal sacrifices to offer, but how and when and who can even offer the sacrifices, and it's incredibly specific. In the New Testament, it's not as though sacrifice through blood for atonement lost its meaning and was somehow found to be arbitrary and insignificant, but of course we have the once-for-all sacrifice and voluntary death of Christ, who became the Lamb of God without blemish or defect. And of course, the author of Hebrews goes to great pains to make sure the Jews are not allowed to overlook the superiority of the sacrifice when set against every single other that had ever been offered since the law was put into effect. And in Galatians, we have Paul pronouncing the old system in comparison to be weak and miserable forces. So this explains not only why sacrifices are no longer necessary, but why it would be completely inappropriate to offer sacrifices. Christians do still believe in and depend on the atoning sacrifice of Christ to satisfy the demands of a just God. So then there are some laws, of course, though not necessarily attached to the same type of punishments, that are explicitly carried over from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And a good example of this would be preserving God's design for sex, marriage, and the family. Sex outside of marriage, along with adultery, is condemned with the practice of homosexuality, and there are even other sins listed on top of that in this category. But Christians still manage somehow to rationalize their way around it, even in lieu of its clarity. To a person who says, I can't follow that law, or it's too difficult, or God doesn't understand my circumstances, we can assure them that that is not the case. One thing we learn from the Pentateuch is God only gives us laws, first of all, if we're able to obey them. And it's worth repeating that God doesn't ask us to feel a particular way about a law. He simply asks us to actually obey it, which is wildly different. He made us, knows what we're made of, and he knows exactly what we're capable of. And secondly, he wouldn't give us a law if we didn't need it. And I think this is the key point. Specific laws addressing sexual purity are really all over the Bible, precisely because God knows we will struggle with it and struggle with it mightily. It kind of reminds me of the sermon Ted Rapone did on submission. To summarize, I'm sure in a very poor way, basically he said, if you view submission as I'll submit as long as I agree, that by definition is not submission at all. Submission anticipates disagreement. So instead of I'll submit as long as unless I disagree, the point is I'll submit even when I don't agree. So in the same way, to reject God's law, and this is important, to reject God's law because we take exception to it misses the exact point of having the law to begin with. All that a person is saying is I don't really care for this, but are not being really upfront and honest enough to just come out and say it. In other words, if we're sinful and God is holy and he knows us, the simple truth is the commands he gives us for our own good are bound to be painful and difficult, and I'm not sure how it could be any other way. Romans 7 puts this well, so the law is holy and the commandment is holy, righteous, and good. And one other quick thing I wanted to address is what about the changes in consequences from the harsh tone of the Old Testament, like death, and to now we're moving on to church discipline, which comes across as more of like a slap on the wrist of some kind. One thing I find interesting is we see long lists of things to obey in the Old Testament replaced with more general principles in the New Testament. And strict and immediate consequences are ostensibly relaxed and delayed, but in the New Testament. But I think the key word there is also delayed. We know that Jesus, for example, took great care to learn the law, follow it. He even taught from it. And as his ministry unfolded, Jesus, since he had the authority to do so, reveals to his hearers that the law is much more than a list of do's and don'ts, but rather a matter of the heart, which is ultimately, of course, our problem. And in doing this, he ultimately actually impugns more people as sinners, like the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. So take the analogy of a loving father who sets down specific rules for his child. She might very well find a way to technically follow these rules and somehow completely miss the point of what he was trying to teach her. Kids are so good at this. It's amazing. It's an art of some kind. As the child develops, though, he can give her broader principles to work with and when he thinks she's ready for it. But the increased freedom, of course, should not be interpreted as the rules no longer matter, do whatever you want. But more accurately, the onus is now on the child to actually carry them out, which actually places a heavier load on her. And while grace and mercy obviously are themes of the New Testament, it in no way, shape, or form implies that sin or its consequences are given some kind of light treatment or they don't matter. In fact, I think you can make the argument that the eternal dangers seem to be highlighted more. It seems that to many, the granting of freedoms and the apparent delaying of consequences, in other words, gives the impression that God doesn't quite care so much about these things, but of course, there is actually no evidence for this if we look further. So as we get on to the major themes, I did want to point one more thing out, and I think this is really important. When we examine the Pentateuch and these books, we'll hopefully not be approaching it with the mindset that we're just trying to resolve issues with it that we might have. Like, why does God come across so differently in the Old Testament versus the New Testament? Which is a perfectly good question, but it's much more effective and helpful to develop our overall understanding of how one treats the one testament as it relates to or supports or explains the other in both directions, again, which is kind of the idea of a paradigm. So to say it another way, rather than focusing on mitigating problematic passages and then leaving it at that and being satisfied, we'll benefit more by seeing how they complement each other and provide insights that the one by itself cannot. You could sort of think of this as a New Testament reading if you read Romans and walked away and didn't do anything else, and then another person read James. Their discussion about the Bible is going to be looking really different later because they're actually stressing different things, but not that they're contradictory. So, as I mentioned in closing last week, even with... Did I skip that? Yeah, no, I didn't. Okay, so on to major themes. As I mentioned last week in closing, the basic conclusions that I'm pretty confident most Christians are aware of is that God definitely loves his people, but he demands obedience. That's just everywhere. But, of course, we have the additional theme that God is faithful even when his people are not. So both of these assume, of course, that a relationship exists, and that's the key point. And not an equal relationship so much, but it is an interactive relationship. So to dig deeper, our question today is more specific. What do we learn about God and how he relates to his people in these accounts that we read? And it just so happens this fits into a nice three-point outline, which is great. So I itemized these in part as we see them reflecting the nature of God and this case we're going to make for all of this, okay? So since God is the main character in the book, as Wendell said, not just in the Pentateuch, but in the entire Bible, it makes sense that we focus on him when we develop our themes. So first of all, we have the sovereignty of God, and you could think of this as a foundational theme, and not you don't have to be too clever to figure this out when you read the Bible. But what's interesting about the text we're using, and I didn't probably give enough due credit to Peter Vogt and his work, it's kind of like, for those of you that have read any of Kenneth Bailey's material in the New Testament, shedding some light on how the culture would take the stories and narratives and teaching that was given, which sounds so different to us. This is kind of the same thing, where you have Near East cultures that are, it's just so long ago and so far away, we just don't have a great way to grasp it without a bit of help. So we could see that sovereignty, especially in some of our discussions, might mean a number of things differently to different people. But for our purposes here, we can agree that what sovereignty definitely does mean is that this includes the fact that everything God wills does happen. He's not outsmarted, overpowered, thwarted, or caught surprised by anything. That is never the case. I'm not here to talk about his providence, which would be more the mechanism of him carrying these things out. The idea is that God is completely in control and that he has designs for his creation and he can fully carry them out. It's pretty simple. This necessarily includes characteristics that he has, like his omnipotence. Otherwise, he couldn't carry them out. As we look at specific passages, something we have to be really intentional about, I think, aside from understanding context, which is one of the big hermeneutical principles, but we have to ask the question, like I said, what does this mean to the original audience? And again, we're separated already very far from the New Testament, but we have pretty much twice the amount of time between the material we're looking at here and even a further distance. So that's important. Again, always to keep in mind, we're studying an account that is far, far, far removed from us by time and geography. So as we go through this, I'm going to list some evidence case by case to support from each of the books. So when we start with creation, we can compare the Genesis narrative with many other Near Eastern creation stories. The biblical account presents what the author called a vigorous polemic. I'm not sure if you guys, it just means it's very different and well asserted, against other understandings of stories that pertain to the origins of the universe at the time. When we read it, Genesis, through 21st century eyes, again, like in the Christian theology book, there's a lot of ink devoted to what about evolution. This would have obviously been nowhere on anyone's radar back at the time. There's no young earth, old earth discussion or anything like that. The question would not have been, was the world created? The question would have been, who or what created the world? Contemporary cultures at the time had multitude of answers for this. Not only does Genesis describe the universe as being created by one God, but it even describes his creating those things that would have been understood as divine entities themselves, such as the sun, the moon, and the stars. And this is incredibly important to not overlook, because we wouldn't think of the stars and the sun as being divine. But of course, that would have been a very common thing. In Genesis 1:16, it describes creation of the two great lights, one to rule the day and the lesser to rule the night. And then it mentions the stars almost as an afterthought. So as I said, in many Near Eastern creation accounts, the sun and moon were deities. You could think of like Ra in Egypt, while the stars were semi-divine entities. And the biblical account actually places them all as part of the created order underneath this one greater God. So this would have been radically countercultural at the time, the insistence that God is able to speak and create everything and to set limits on those things that other people would consider to be worthy of worship, clearly points to the supremacy and even distinctiveness of God. So we see two slightly different creation accounts, as you probably know, in Genesis 1 and 2. And in Genesis 1, God is God is not created, that's heretical. God is referred to as Elohim. I had a whole list of words, Josh, I wanted to run by you. I forgot all of them. Anyway, you're just going to have to deal with it. A more generic name, as it turns out, for God or even gods with a lowercase g, and is not named or identified as Yahweh until Genesis chapter 2, which is considered to be, of course, a more developed idea. So as you would assume, there's been no shortage of scholarship going into the source documents of the Pentateuch and what happened here, and are these from different people, or what exactly is going on here. One really compelling idea is that the author, presumably Moses, used different names for God for rhetorical effect. For example, in chapter 1, he introduces this great and different creator God, surpassing all others, and prompts the question, who is this God that created even those things that we have worshipped? And then chapter 2 comes out more clearly and answers the question, this is the unique and powerful Yahweh, God of Israel. The other common narrative seen in the other surrounding cultures is, of course, that of the flood, or the great deluge. For example, Atrahasis in the Akkadian epic includes a flood story where the gods resolved to send a flood and destroy humanity because the noise made by the humans was disturbing their sleep, like we all have done as parents, right? We'll just flood the bedroom. One god warned Atrahasis, who built an ark and was saved. Following the flood, though, the gods were surprised to discover anyone had survived, but were relieved because they were desperate for sacrifices since they were hungry. Apparently, their decision to destroy humanity was a little short-sighted. So you contrast this with the biblical account, where not only God foresees what is going to happen, but the reasons for the flood are moral. They are not petty. The sin of human beings ultimately becomes so egregious that God executes judgment, as he has a right to. So he is, of course, neither surprised nor terrified by the flood, unlike the God's reactions in the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example. And a favorite account pointing to God's sovereignty, of course, is the fascinating account of Joseph toward the end of Genesis. Chapter 50, verse 20, is often quoted as Joseph saying to his brothers directly, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." And we're going to come back to that passage shortly. Then we have an Exodus. It's more evidence, of course. While nothing can really compare to the creation of the universe, or perhaps even the terribleness of the flood, the plagues in Exodus actually come deliberately to point out God's sovereignty. That was their express purpose, unlike the other accounts. And understanding the backdrop of the Near Eastern cultures reading these accounts, the plagues are probably best understood as a confrontation between Yahweh and the gods of Egypt. We see this even before the first plague, where the Egyptian magicians, you know, throw down their staffs, which supposedly turn into snakes, as does Aaron's, except his swallows theirs up. Consider also that Pharaoh himself was considered to be a deity. And the fact that this all happened when Aaron was 83 and Moses was 80, and then they go to the desert for 40 years, that seems like a miracle in and of itself. An interesting detail that would not have been overlooked at the time is that this all takes place within the land of Egypt. So gods, think lowercase g, would have been largely understood as territorial, and their power and influence were often limited to the geographical area of their dominion. So like for a sports buff, we'd say they had home court advantage of some kind, I don't know. Not good with sports metaphors. So, on top of all that, we can add to it. God is not unable to control his great power. He protects the Israelites from seven of the ten plagues. So he doesn't wield this great power out of control. Most notably, the plague of the death of the firstborn. He gives them clear ways to avoid the repercussions of that. And of course, we could go on about the parting of the sea and the countless other signs and miracles. One other thing worth noting is that what is initiated in Exodus is the covenant or treaty at Mount Sinai that takes up like 12 chapters while God is giving Noah the original 10 stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. God is dictating to Israel his terms as a superior king, or sometimes called the suzerain, and Israel is the vassal, or the lesser of the two parties, and as they are the one accepting the terms of the agreement. Now, today, we don't relate to each other on these terms except in some sort of epic fantasy movie, but that would have been very, very commonly understood back at the time. In Leviticus, among other things that could be said about Leviticus, it's critical to note that the sacrifices prescribed by Yahweh were not a means for men to manipulate God, as was common in other belief systems, as though he would starve or need something from them. We also see increased emphasis on the uniqueness of Israel, which is a big deal, and they're being set apart, which further underscores the singularity of Yahweh. The reason this can't be overstated is because through the nation of Israel, of course, as we know, the Messiah was to come and all other nations were to be blessed and brought to God. In Numbers, the thing to note here actually is the numbers. How many Israelites? We have a number of census here. We have the census at the end of Genesis. And then the first census, I think, in chapter 1 of Numbers. As they enter Egypt, how many Israelites were there? Does anybody remember? 70. There are 70. When they leave Egypt, anybody know that number? I didn't. Yeah, it's like 633,500. And this could be referring to groups of people, individual people. Obviously, some of the language can be unclear. The point is, there's a lot of them. Right, and the point here is they've been slaves for hundreds of years. This is not exactly being left alone to flourish in the Garden of Eden, right? So, you know, what else could this demonstrate except God's protection, deliberate protection over them? And when the Israelites rebel against Moses and Aaron, Yahweh defends Moses' unique status time and again, highlighting his sovereign ability to choose his servants and determine their roles. And we, by the way, see this consistently throughout the entire Bible. God cares about proper authority and structure. You can go up through the time of Paul. It is very, very, very consistent. Every single instance where the Israelites challenge Yahweh's authority or plan, of course, God is vindicated and shown to be the utterly unique and supreme God in every case. Then we have in Numbers 23, there are many sovereignly controlled details in this really interesting account of Balaam. One that's less often focused on are the oracles that Balaam presents, and they're noteworthy because they serve to reaffirm previous promises that were made, both as a source of confidence and a warning for the Israelites. They will succeed only when they acknowledge and live out their dependency on God. And then in Deuteronomy, Since much of Deuteronomy is a summary of Jewish history and law up to that point, we don't see it necessarily a lot of different things there. Probably its most distinctive contribution comes from the development or theme of God's sovereignty in chapter 4 with an extended, very long discussion on idolatry. Here Moses reminds the people they're to worship Yahweh alone, for he is unlike any of the gods of the nations. As we noted, the reason for the prohibition is because Yahweh created everything else that exists. So including anything that they were attempting to worship, he created it. So what we have here is an attempt to worship creation rather than the creator. And you can see that theme coming up in Romans chapter 1. It's funny because it shows today, you know, people, they kind of puff out their chests and they're like, they defy religion and they're like, oh, I believe in science. It's really not any different than what they did, you know. A people group they would have called superstitious and primitive were worshiping creation, and I'm not sure that if you believe there's science and nothing else, I'm not even sure that's different in the least. In agreement with the rest of the Pentateuch, Deuteronomy portrays God as the one who provides instruction and proper living, but because of it's by virtue of his being sovereign. Again, the crowning touch is that Israel was to live differently, to have a different type of community, because they were in a relationship with a different kind of God, and all of this, again, points exclusively to the supremacy of Yahweh. So the sovereignty of God is not an easy theme to miss in the Old Testament at all. Here we have probably nearly just as obvious, and that is the seriousness of sin. What if you ask somebody who read the Old Testament, or just say the first five books of the Old Testament, whether God considers sin to be a serious matter? I'm not sure there would be much doubt on the answer to that. In fact, a lot of people have complaints to lodge against God on that matter, that he just takes sin way too seriously. Like, geez, God, lighten up. Sin, for our purpose, by the way, means a transgression against divine law, or basically you could think of it as choosing against God. In Genesis, a strikingly different tone is taken in the nature of how God relates to his people. Gods typically were very angry and frustrated with humans and had temper tantrums and consistently exhibited over-the-top displays of emotion in the long list of myths that we can read about the fall. But what's interesting about, I think, the account of the fall that we read, which ruins in the Bible, this ruins what Adam and Eve were meant to enjoy, it seems to contain more a note of sadness than, you know, harsh or petulant anger or vengeance. On God's part, the fall alone is adequate to make our point that human sin matters. I'm not even sure you need anything else. But there are certainly repercussions, and they are very grave, but God doesn't sneer at them or laugh at them or even raise his voice from what we can tell. He lists the consequences unequivocally because there's no changing them, and they are banished from Eden. The pervasiveness of the infecting, I guess you could say, power of sin is seen already in the next chapter with Cain and Abel and the first murder. The flood, of course, brought about the destruction of nearly all of mankind. We have the well-known, doesn't matter. Anyway, how many of you get distracted if there's a typo on a slide? Okay, not very many. Well, that's interesting. Okay, that's good to know. We have the Tower of Babel. And then, of course, one that we haven't, I don't think, talked about yet is Sodom and Gomorrah and so many others, that sin infects everything everywhere. In Exodus, the account of Pharaoh and the plagues, of course, shows that God is not only interested in the sins of his people, but the sinful actions of all humans. As you would see in the flood. In what is sometimes called the Book of the Covenant, which is found in Exodus 20 through 23, this highlights the seriousness of sin through the penalties incurred for various offenses, serious transgressions, which would include being disloyal to Yahweh, as well as murder, kidnapping, and even disloyalty to your parents, are all punishable by death. The fact that an offender might forfeit his or her life obviously accentuates the seriousness of sin. in Leviticus. As you can imagine, Leviticus, where the theme of the seriousness of sin is developed primarily, again, through legal stipulations. The first seven chapters describe offerings and sacrifices that were required to deal with the sins committed by the Israelites. Many of them, as I said last week, were for unintentional sins. This means that even an offense that is committed unwittingly matters to God and has to be dealt with accordingly. And that, of course, would be an easy thing to overlook. The idea in Leviticus of cleanness, which is not to be confused with what my mom loves so much, which is cleanliness, and that would be how free something is of dirt or germs. That is not what cleanness means. It is quite a profound idea, actually, something we might be quick to dismiss as random or possibly even pedantic. What it means is it refers to how well something adheres to a world order established by Yahweh. It could be thought of as his idea of this is normal. Unclean things cause pollution in the sanctuary since they reflect disorder in God's good creation. So as a result, Leviticus calls for avoiding unclean things for purification purposes, but not just for the individual, but also for the sanctuary itself. So interestingly, most of the instances where one is declared unclean, there's no actual guilt associated with being unclean, but the purity system and the remedy for uncleanness served as a reminder that the post-fall world was marred and disfigured because of human sin. In Numbers, one famous incident we reviewed last week was Numbers 13 through 14, which records one of the Israelite rebellions that followed the reports of the 12 who went to explore the land of Canaan. They had almost made it there, but their individual sin of the spies who went in, or at least the 10 that were unfaithful, and their influence on the people prevented an entire generation from entering, and that's a pretty serious penalty. Numbers also is where we read of Moses' own rebellion in chapter 20. He strikes this rock twice. It was considered a major enough transgression that Moses was only allowed to see the promised land, but not to enter it. Now, my point here is not to examine why such a penalty was enacted, but I couldn't help but quickly summarize it. I thought that might be helpful in case we don't come back to it, although I suspect that we will. Basically, Moses has a little bit of a temper here, and in verse 10, he says to the Israelites, "You were rebels, shall we bring you water out of this rock?" And basically, he's bringing himself glory and aligning himself with God in a completely inappropriate fashion. And when you read it, it still has a little bit of a tone of falling flat, like that seems pretty harsh, not that that really matters what we think about it. But when you add to this the fact that his actions take place in the presence of the entire assembly and that he's their leader held in one of the highest positions ever held, we can maybe imagine that the fallout of that, if it went unaddressed, would have been possibly unimaginable. It kind of reminds me of I think it's Acts 5, where Ananias and Sapphira come in. I mean, I'm assuming not everybody who lies to a church elder dies, you know. But apparently that was significant enough at the time that it had to be addressed with, and it's sort of like an example had to be set. In some ways, anyway, it's just a fascinating account. In Deuteronomy, we have the book that most emphasizes, as I said, the need for loyalty and completeness to Yahweh. This is where we find the Shema, which is in chapter 6. It's just important enough. It's fairly brief. I'll read it. Starting in verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give to you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." And I think that's a great passage where you can see if you want to, if you're a weird list maker and you're like, okay, you want me to do this, this, and this, and this, you can do all those things and still completely miss the point that seems quite obvious that he wants devotion. And of course, all this is just part of the case for showing that God never treats sin lightly. It's easy to think that we might prefer a God who would look the other way when it comes to sin. That's not uncommon for us to hear. But not only is this impossible, because of course he would no longer be God and he would no longer be holy, but he would also no longer care about justice. He would no longer care about making things right. So this is what God delights in, and so should we. We should not be interested in sweeping sin under the rug because it makes us a little bit more comfortable. Sin itself and our rebellion against God should be the focus of our hatred, obviously not God himself. That means, and the fact that we sin against an infinite God and we see finite retribution in the Old Testament is pretty amazing. And lastly, we have something that really nicely balances this all out because, you know, point one is fairly neutral, point two is not good, and point three is the good news. Since God is sovereign and holy, he takes sin seriously. Then, if all that's true, what would be the inevitable result of these themes? Well, it should be our complete and swift destruction. But, of course, this is not what we see. Everything we've examined so far accompanies, as I said last week numerous times, God limiting wrath, but without any merit to do so necessarily. In Genesis, we know that after the fall, creation was marred, but it was not destroyed. Cain, the first murderer's life, is actually protected, and a mark is placed on him. Mankind was wiped out in the flood, but a remnant was deliberately preserved. But there's actually much more to that account. It's God who instructs Noah on the construction of the ark. He preserves the animals. He tells them when the floodwaters are coming. He closes and seals the door of the ark, and eventually he causes the water to recede. The highly esteemed patriarchs even sin frequently, but they are not just eradicated from their position. God is indeed patient and certainly more than we can imagine. Oh, sorry, and remember in Genesis 50, verse 20, where Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." The less quoted second half, which is very interesting, says, "Because this is to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." So what that means, of course, is that God worked all of this not only to protect his chosen people, but he cares for and shows concerns for the other nations as well. In Exodus, it's significant that in the magician's demonstration of staffs turned into snakes, when Aaron demonstrates God's superiority, at that moment, Pharaoh actually had a chance to let the Israelites go before the first plague even came. Of course, that didn't happen. And later, when referring to Yahweh as the great king, or suzerain, as I said, dictating his terms to the vassal state Israel, the fact that God favors Israel at all, or to begin with, is, of course, sufficiently gracious and humbling on his part. He is, in a way, lowering himself to them. Oh, I'm not there yet. Yes, I am. Also, we see that the regulations of the treaty given by God from Mount Sinai are not arbitrary, like to restrict their pleasure, for example, but by virtue of his, by being their sovereign creator, he requires what is good, best, and right for them. But even if God said, "This is how it's going to be, just because I said so," due to his character and because he is perfect, the goodness of the law would still be intact anyway. Add to this that God was under no obligation to give them the law to begin with, but he did so out of his love for his creatures. Just because it's hard doesn't mean it's not a good thing to do. We can simply look back at the time before the flood when men and women were basically given over to do whatever they felt like, and it did not turn out well. What happened after the Israelites made and worshipped the golden calf? Well, Moses pleaded with God not to destroy them, and not only did he limit his wrath, but he replaced the original stone tablets that Moses had broken. This is a great excerpt from Exodus chapter 34. It says, "So Moses chiseled, the first tablets were inscribed by God, and now Moses has to do all the work himself." I'm not sure what the significance of that is, but it's really interesting. So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. As he passed in front of Moses, he proclaimed, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished." And of course, again, we see a great deal of balance in all of that. In Leviticus, the sacrificial system described here serves to show how God's grace in, I think, much the same way the law does. Again, we can't miss the fact that the fact that God determined there should be a system for dealing with human failures is itself a manifestation of God's grace, if that makes sense. He can destroy us, and he can't look the other way, so a system has to be put in place to deal with things. It's just reality. So that would be the sacrifice for sin. A neat passage in chapter 7, verse 11, "For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I myself have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life." So in so many ways, it is simply a gift of God. And thinking globally, since Israel exists to bless all nations, as I said, this further highlights the graciousness of God. In the book of Numbers, chapter 13 and 14, as I said, that's where the rebellion, as they're about to enter the land of Canaan, we noted the repercussions, but again, they were very limited. I wouldn't doubt at all, once it was declared, you know, this generation is not going to enter the promised land, I'm sure many of them said, we screwed up, but at least we didn't mess this up for our children. And Moses was allowed to see it, as I said, even though he was not allowed to actually enter it. And then we have in Deuteronomy, the impassioned speeches, which take up most of Deuteronomy, that Moses delivers are clear manifestations of God's grace, because Moses, as this exceptional prophet, he is setting out to reteach his people what they need to know in order to survive and thrive in the land. And again, to foster this unique kind of community to which they were divinely called. Yahweh doesn't leave the people, in other words, to figure it out for themselves. He literally teaches them and actually paves the way for them in that way. And again, from the viewpoint of the rest of the world, the laws given to Noah after the flood and the establishing of the nation of Israel after the flood just creates this stability of that did not exist in humanity before that time. I mean, that just can't be missed. Okay, so there's one last thing worth saying about all of these. All these themes, the sovereignty of God, the seriousness of sin, and the grace of God, are not standalone ideas, but they're inextricably interrelated. They have to be. In every case we touched on today, and others that you could read about, I doubt you could actually come up with an example in the Old Testament where you don't actually see all of these themes interlaced in the story. And this makes sense, again, because all of these things are actually part of God's character. So we might summarize it in this way, saying, because of human sin, God acted decisively in history to restore creation to its intended glory. This is a manifestation of his grace, for he acted out of love, not obligation. So there's much more that can be said. I'm sure I'm way out of time. I wanted to close with what I think is a very fitting passage from The Problem of Pain, of all books. And I can't help but think this would be an encouragement to the Jewish people of that time. It doesn't do them any good now, but you know, they didn't always have things so easy. So we're not trying to paint some kind of rosy picture here, but a very realistic one. But I love how this quote relates to so many things here that we've talked about. "We are not metaphorically, but in very truth, a divine work of art, something that God is making, and therefore something with which he will not be satisfied until it has a certain character." Here we come up against what I have called the intolerable compliment. It is natural for us to wish that God had designed us for a less glorious purpose and a less arduous destiny, but then we are wishing not for more love, but less.